wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake. This is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
Down in the new basement studios by the lake. Mars is in the news.
Mars is in the news, yes. You know, sometimes different planets go into the news. That right now it's Mars. Actually, really, what I was thinking about is there are just certain times when a topic just seems to emerge from different fronts at the same time, and it's very convenient. I think it's one of those things, you know, like when you hear a word sometimes and you hear it again and you're like, that's very odd that I heard that. I think you only notice it when it happens multiple times. So right now, Mars is in a couple of things in terms of facts about Mars.
Yes.
We had NASA talking about...
Gave a press conference.
Yeah, talking about it, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And in the media or in culture, where we have a movie coming.
The big movie, The Martian.
Yes. Which, oddly enough, is about Mars.
Is about Mars.
Well, or people and Mars, I guess.
But it's a play on words, The Martian, because it's not about a Martian.
Right.
And that's not a spoiler.
No.
It's about a man on Mars.
More about that later.
Yeah, but anyway,
first of all, you know, some people might not know what Mars is. So okay. I need to give some basic facts.
No,
you know,
please do it.
I performed some research, okay. I.e. searched the internet, looked at Wikipedia. Mars,
of course, is a planet. Can I say something before you launch into that?
Okay.
I'm very distressed that you said, I searched the internet. I always give people credit that you just know all this stuff. Whereas I'm the one who admits I found it on the internet.
You know, sometimes I'm just confirming my existing knowledge.
Okay.
But I'll tell you actually some of the things. So Mars, fourth planet from the sun. I think everybody knew that. That part I knew.
Yeah.
Red, you know, in color when you see it in the sky. That's because it has a lot of iron oxide, which I guess is sort of, I don't know if it's red for the same reason that blood is red. You know, when blood gets oxygenated, so it's iron oxide. I think that's what gives it its red color.
Okay.
So that might be the same as what's going on the planet. And we have a little music in the background.
Which we will come to in a moment.
It is half the diameter of Earth, which I always thought of it as more the same size. Now, Venus
is
almost the same size as Earth.
People always refer to Venus as our sister planet.
Right.
In
Venus being now that Venus is the second planet from the sun.
Right.
You got Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. And so they're on either side of us.
You know, I must confess, I never realized Mars was half. I always think of Venus, Earth, and Mars.
Right, being sort of the same.
Yes, three siblings lurking about the universe corner.
Yeah, Venus is smaller. And I mean, sorry, Mars is smaller. And of course, Mars is named for the Roman god of war, Mars.
That's right.
That's why it's Mars. Yep. Venus being the... Venus is another Roman god.
The god of love.
Of love and beauty.
What's Earth? So, Earth's not anything, is it? There's no Earth in any of those stories.
I mean, they didn't have to name it after something. They were already there.
Yeah.
Like, you had to discover it, which is actually kind of what we were talking about beforehand, is that, you know, we're going to talk about Mars in popular culture, but I guess if you talked about, you know, Roman theology... You know, and a multi-god sort of... That is a version of popular culture. And just to think about the fact that we're talking about more or less prehistory, it's certainly thousands of years BC, that the people first noticed, hey, Mars, that's red. We're going to give it this attributes. You know, that's going to be the god of war. That's what we're going to sort of ascribe to Mars out there versus Venus, which we're going to have be the god of love, goddess of love, I guess. So it's interesting that it was already like a putting it in a place, you know, in terms of how we viewed it relative to other celestial bodies and ourselves.
When you say viewed it too, I'm trying to think, and I am not an astronomer by any stretch of the imagination. I can name certain constellations, Big Bear, the Hunter, you know, that type of thing. I do know Venus is a planet that they always say you can see it with your naked eye. You can see it in the sky. But I don't think the same applies to Mars.
No, it does, yeah.
Oh, you can see Mars.
Yeah, that's what people in the earliest times noticed it was red even. You know,
and oh, you can see that it's red.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I do. It is funny. Like, you know, we put us out there to try to find it. We wouldn't
find
it. I have no idea what's going on.
All these stars look alike to me.
They didn't have a telescope at that point in time to check it out. So, in fact, there's I forget which one of the great early, you know, Roman, Greek astronomers...
First
realized it was further away than the moon. Like, they watched as the moon and Mars crossed, that Mars disappeared. So they're like, aha, Mars must be further away than the moon, something we kind of take for granted now. But it has two moons. They're really sort of small, irregular-shaped moons, and it's thought that they are captured asteroids.
Okay.
Speaking of asteroids.
That's right.
There's a They call it I think it's called the Trojans. There's like a series of asteroids that are in the same orbit as Mars. And Trojans, I guess, being like the soldiers of Mars.
Okay. That's
how they got that name.
Yeah, fair enough.
And so they thought they're captured there. Has a very, very, very thin atmosphere, like 1/100th of the atmosphere of Earth.
What's its gravity like?
Less. I mean, I don't have the facts right in front of me, but I think it's something like 38% of the gravity. There is definitely known to be frozen water. There's polar ice caps on either end. It has a very similar setup to Earth in that it has a certain amount of tilt.
Okay.
And so the seasons change. So in fact, I read something that said when the polar ice caps start to melt, they melt so aggressively that there's winds above up to 250 miles an hour.
Oh, wow.
From them. Now, mind you, if you have only 1/100th of the atmosphere, standing in a 250 mile an hour wind may not be too difficult, because it doesn't have as much mass to push things around. In fact, we're going to talk a bunch about...
So it's less blowy.
Yeah, well, it's blowing as fast, but has less impact on you there. And in fact, one of the Martian movie that we'll talk about, some of the science, that was one of the critiques, is apparently there's a big wind incident that would not have really played out as they depict.
Because that is what we're going to get to.
Yeah, we're going to get to.
So those of you there who aren't interested in the facts, bear with us. Because we're getting there.
But
we're setting it up,
so
though.
The first thing on the facts, because the first piece that we mentioned is a touchstone recently, so I mentioned water because it's generally known that there is frozen water. Just this week, September 28th, NASA comes out and says, you know, they see evidence of actual flowing water on the planet.
Yeah.
It's not like they see a river going, but what they did is they saw... You know, there's certain patterns in hills and, you know, there's mountains and the like there. And what they noticed was these things were changing on a seasonal basis. Like a little pattern that you might have said, oh, you know, that's like a dry riverbed or something, you know, maybe some winds or something that happened in the past. But they were actually growing during a season when it would have been warmer and therefore things were melting. And then it would dissipate over time over in the off season and kind of go back and forth. And there would be changes over and over. They call them... recurring slope linnae, L-I-N-A-E.
Okay.
I don't know if I pronounced that properly or not. But so there'd be changes over the seasons. And it's effectively water, but the thought is it's brine, basically heavily salted, not sodium chloride, but like different types of salt in the elemental sense.
But it is some sort of liquid.
Right. And the thought is just like we throw rock salt in your driveway to melt the ice. With enough salt in there, it can stay in a liquid state at a much colder temperature. And so that's the thought is what maybe is running there and causing these patterns is that.
Interesting.
So, this is why I say in the confluence, right? Like, you wonder whether they made this announcement because people were talking about Mars
in
the media, like in the movie or what's going on there, you know?
I'm going to tell you right now, because there was that story, and we are going to talk about the movie The Martian a bit later. The director is Ridley Scott. Not Ridley Scott. He was asked this week if he already...
Ridley Scott is related to Diddley Scott.
Yes. Ridley Scott was asked if he knew about NASA's announcement about water, and he was like, oh, yeah, I already knew that. So there seems to be a lot of NASA jumping on public interest in the movie.
That seems to be their pattern lately on things.
Yeah, desperate to stay relevant.
So, I mentioned the atmosphere, which really brings us... an almost random first reference in terms of a cultural touchstone, which is the movie Total Recall.
That's right. Although before we get to the movie Total Recall,
I need to
explain to people what they heard in the background there. While we were talking about Mars, we were playing from Holst, a turn of the 20th century classical musician. Right. He did a famous opus called The Planets. There is a piece of music for each one of the planets. In the background there, we were playing Mars, God of War. So in the background, you could hear some very martial music.
Martial. No coincidence.
No, maybe. I don't know.
I do.
Martial music, very violent, boom, as you might have heard in the background. But that is Mars, the God of War. And like I say, it's a long piece that runs. There is a piece for Venus, which is obviously a more romantic, melodic piece. There's a piece for Saturn, for Jupiter. But a famous... I guess it's not a symphony, because a symphony is a certain number of movements, but it is a very famous piece of classical music.
Piece. I guess maybe all the planets together make a symphony, and the Mars one alone wouldn't be a symphony, but...
No, I mean, I always thought a symphony was five five movements, though.
Beats me.
Oh, well, there you go. See, I have some facts. I'm now saying, well, I don't know if it's true or not, but I'm now saying it's a symphony is five acts.
You've claimed some facts anyway.
All right. So anyway, we are basically, now that everyone's had the rundown on the planet Mars, we are going to talk about Mars and popular culture.
Or culture, generally.
Culture,
I guess it's all going to be popular culture from here on out. The part that I was thinking was just more culture was like about the using it as a you know, ancient Rome and the like.
But. All right, so Eric just mentioned the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie Total Recall.
Right.
And this is
1990, based on a Philip K. Dick short story.
We can remember it for Wholesale.
Right.
And I actually... I'm loading up something right here. We actually, for those of you who don't know, I'm actually now desperately killing a few seconds while my technology gets up to speed. We actually have a basement studio that looks like a control center right now. We have a machinery everywhere.
We do have quite a few things going.
We have all kinds of leads tablets. Everywhere, tablets, computers, the usual stuff as we attempt to, oh dear, and now your internet has stopped working.
Oh, I don't know if my internet stopped working. Maybe your tablet stopped working.
Okay. Well, anyway. Houston, we have a problem.
All right.
Okay, here we go. I think this is going to work now. I'm sorry. I hope it's going to work right now.
Get your ass to Mars. 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 Get your ass to Mars.
Can anybody tell who that is? I mean, that 1990 is now. There could be some people listening who don't know this stuff.
Get your ass to Mars.
25-year-old movie now.
It's an old enough movie to have been remade a couple of years
badly.
Ago badly with right. Colin Farrell, an actor that I know I like and right. I think you liked. And I think Jessica Biel and Kate Beckinsale were all in that movie, in the remake. The original, right. Of course, again, as we were saying, based on a Philip K. Dick short story, stars Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Sharon Stone would have been a bigger name, but although she played a smaller role.
Also, the villain is Ronnie Cox, who, mm-hmm. if people don't know who that is by name, he's actually a country musician. He is now, but he was...
Really?
If you remember the Beverly Hill Cop movies with...
Yeah,
Eddie Murphy, he's in the early ones, he is the boss in Beverly Hills. But he was also a big sort of character actor in... he was also the villain in RoboCop.
I was going to say, RoboCop, he's another bad guy.
Directed by Paul Verhoeven, a Dutch director who also made, obviously, RoboCop. He also made Starship Troopers. And he recently made a World War II movie, I think it was called The Book, that was excellent. But it was a summer movie, made a ton of money. It is full of great Arnold lines.
The story from Philip K. Dick was in 1966. So, you know, this gives you an idea. We'll see this quite a few times that these Mars stories, they've been redone a number of different ways. So this was a book. It's been done as a movie two times, but some other versions we're going to talk, some other cultural touchstones about Mars we're going to talk about.
Because I'm going to make this statement now, and we're going to continue to make it. For some reason, Mars resonates with us culturally more than any other planet.
All right. I'm going to pose another thesis here.
Okay, do it.
It isn't so much about what Mars does, but it is a convenient vehicle for other misgivings of people or misgivings or thoughts or expand. Actually, I shouldn't say misgivings. Just it becomes a convenient vehicle, an allegorical vehicle for other sort of vectors in popular culture.
And
it's concern about outside, whether it's aspirations to adventure and explore. Where do you talk about exploring the place that's right next door? You know.
Yeah, and I guess that's the reason. I mean, you know, maybe Trump would get more votes if he was talking about Mars and not Mexico.
That's right. Well, you know, next time around, they go. So
as you said, Mars is closer than Venus or not? I always think of Venus as being closer.
No,
it's
closer. Well, I will say the other reason it works better for sci-fi purposes because despite the fact that Venus looks a little bit more like Earth and then it has clouds and things like that, it's the hottest planet. It's hotter than even Mercury because
it
has an atmosphere that captures the heat and it's like, I think it's an ammonia atmosphere. It is completely unusable in terms of a place to go, even though it's terrestrial. Whereas Mars... There are things about it that suggest it could be a place you could go. So maybe a little mix of cultural and scientific significance.
As we'll discover as we move forward, there's plenty of music that references Mars, but the only song for Venus is Bananarama's I'm Your Venus, Your Desire.
Which isn't really even a banana. It's a remake also.
It's a remake of Shocking Blue, I think, is the 60s band. So there you go. It's a trivia for
you. But the reason we picked Total Recall in Edge First
that's
is only
the
because
only time Bananarama will be referenced on the Atlantic Voice podcast.
Can't guarantee that. Okay. it ties in because one of the plot features is the idea that there was a former culture there that they could turn on the atmosphere. Like, this atmosphere is locked away, and it's all about corporate greed.
That's
and
right.
Trying to keep everybody repressed. And, once the rebellion gets a hold of the atmosphere and lets it loose, then we're all able to frolic about.
It's interesting. We're going to stop and just start throwing film titles at you while mm-hmm. we go through this. That plot is basically the plot of pretty much everything sci-fi and Mars, other than one of the most recent movies. If you think of some other B movies, there's John Carpenter's Ghosts of Mars, which deals with a hidden civilization from the past whose spirits come to life and then basically get into a fight with Natasha Hendrich and Ice Cube. There you go. Great movie. John Carpenter, the maker of Escape from New York and the original The Fog and Halloween. I'm trying to think what else. Obviously, we are going to discuss the Ray Bradbury novel.
Just going to let them all go? Like, are we just going to rattle them off? Can we just go through them in a normal order we were going to go through?
Okay, fair
enough.
Anyway, Total Recall. Total Recall is the most accessible of modern Mars movies.
I guess so.
I think. Because it's an Arnold movie where Arnold says things like, even though it's all about ancient space culture, basically it's about Arnold shooting everyone and saying things like...
Well, that's the thing. So it is different than, I think, a lot of these movies in that a lot of the movies are about... folks coming here, like it's about the transit as much as anything. It's either about like being invaded by Martians,
right,
or us going to Mars and the project of going to Mars.
Yes. Okay.
You know, like whereas this one, when they go to Mars, it's just
Mars is
another
place.
Setting.
Yes.
You know, it's just they hop on a flight and takes the commercial flight. Remember, he's got the woman's head on, and
that's right. He's at customs in Mars, and then
the disguise
shoot him out.
And
yes.
They shoot him out. So. I think it's unique in that regard because it doesn't have to be set in Mars. It's convenient because it provided the vehicle for things, but it doesn't, in and of itself, it's not really about Mars.
No, but you know something? Now I'm now going to challenge that assertion a little bit. And I now don't want to suddenly, even though it is based on a Philip K. Dick novel, obviously a science fiction writer of great note, let's not muck around and try and make out the Total Recall. It's really not a lot more than an Arnold Schwarzenegger shoot 'em up. And yet... The whole premise behind the movie is that continuing dream aspiration that we have that we will colonize Mars. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
like Total Recall is, this is what happens when we colonize Mars. I don't know if I'm really making my point there.
But I don't think that's really the plot thrust of it. I mean,
But what I'm saying is, ultimately, one of the reasons Mars is so fascinating to us as a cult, as a species, is this notion expressed through popular culture that we're going to be able to live there one day. It used to be the moon, but now no one's talking about moon bases. Everyone talks about even NASA. Yeah, we're going to send a mission to Mars.
All right.
Do you know what I mean? That's all I'm trying to say. Total Recall takes it as a given that we will have done that.
All right. Well, we'll come back to that. The next one.
The way you said that, you just completely blew off my point. Well, we'll come back to that.
Well, you know,
it's
going to be a thread, and I don't want to overplow anything.
It actually is overplow. That's how Arnold would say it.
Oh.
I do not want to overplow
that's
that.
Very good. Consider
this a divorce.
The first thing to talk about in terms of like a popular culture item is actually older even than your classic composition there. It's H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, originally written in 1898. Like many books at the time, it was really released, I think, through a serial, on a serial basis in magazines, or I don't know if we call them magazines at the time, but they ultimately end up coming here. H.G. Wells is the writer of Island of Dr. Moreau, The Time Machine, The Invisible Man. Did not only do sci-fi stuff, though, did other sort of novels and fiction and the like. And you're getting way ahead of things over there with your tablet.
No, I'm just getting things lined up for whenever you say go.
As a book at the time...
I've never read it.
No, nor have I. I mean...
I read The Time Machine when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I've read that.
And I read
that was more of like a Time Machine would be more of like a high school assignment.
Yeah, and I read Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. So what I'm saying is I did read some fantasy, and I think I read First Men on the Moon, which is H.G. Wells, but I've never read War of the Worlds.
Right. So, I mean, I don't there's an there the most recent iteration of it is in the nine the 2012 move no 2005 wait what year was that
I think it's 5 or 7. It's after Minority Report.
2005, Spielberg did with Tom Cruise, did A War of the Worlds, where they come to Boston. Obviously not going to be the same as the 1898 version, which was set in that time period.
That's right.
But, you know, the plot line is these folks come from Mars. They beat the heck out of us.
I actually think these folks is a very kind way to describe three-legged tripod monsters with laser beams.
Well, those are just their machines, right? And then when they ultimately fail because they get sick.
That's right.
And so some interesting things about when you look at the period, you know, 1898, we're talking about well before World War I even to think about war allegories and then.
Yeah.
But I understand, I just found this out in researching it, that this was a part or it is a part of what there was they called invasion literature in Britain from the 1870 to like 19 basically up to World War One, where there was lots of books about invasions of Great Britain because there was a certain amount of
paranoia.
Concern yeah. about the things. And there's a book, I think it's called Battle of, I want to say it's Dorking, although I may have misspelt.
No, that's Craig's Dorking is okay. A place. Yeah.
Okay. That is about Germans invading. And apparently if you look at that next to the War of the Worlds, H.G. Wells thing, there's a lot of parallelism into the way it went. Like the Germans came, they succeed, they have to fall back, and everybody ultimately pushes them out. That's the same sort of plot line in War of the Worlds.
It just occurred to me, this is sort of similar to 1950s here in America when they had the whole McCarthy Reds Under the Bed, and that's when there was that sort of burst of B-movie science fiction.
Oh, it's similar in the fact that
it's similar.
I mean,
the notion that that's how
sci-fi is always oftentimes allegorical, or at least the successful stuff is because it touches a nerve
on people.
It's not enough to just be like, oh, look, science stuff, look, spaceships and things.
No, and that's
got to be something where people it resonates with people. So, in fact, I mean, you can look at that.
So it's a similar.
The next big event for War of the Worlds is in 1938. Orson Welles does a radio broadcast. This is before Orson Welles is even doing movies. Really, he's an actor, but he's not directing movies. He was doing this radio show. It was different types of theater on the radio, Mercury Theater on the air. He does War of the Worlds on the radio. And on that, the way they did it was as news broadcasts. Like
yes.
It was like a news bulletin. And the story always goes, and what I always heard was, oh, it induced a panic, you know, because people would tune in. They tune into they even mentioned there's like a Edgar McCarthy, you know, the puppetry guy. Is that the right name? Edgar? He's Candace Bergen's
father. I do not know.
Anyway, so he had a show, and it was like the way it broke out was that people could have tuned across, changed their radio station over, and if they stumbled in and they didn't hear the disclaimer up front, they thought it was a real bulletin. Now, some of the things I was reading saying, that's one of those just sort of fables. It's not like there were panics in the streets about Mars invading us.
There were people that heard it on the radio and then used their telephonic device to register their concern with the station.
Yeah, I think there's probably some people.
Yeah. I don't
in
think
fact,
it was
in a, fact, I mean, I think I did. What they did read was true was that a number of people, whether they thought it was real or not, were upset because
the Lone Ranger
was manipulative.
Been
no. Maybe. I mean, but I think it was because the thought was you're tricking people. Like it was a new version of theater that we would nowadays we would say, oh, that's neat. It's like a new type of media approach, like found footage type movies.
Yeah.
With, you know, Blair, all those sort
Blair
of
Witch Project.
This was a new version of things. People were accustomed being presented their things in a very, here's a play or here's the movie and it's done like a play. So the idea of sort of aping real things in life, people may have been upset at, even if they weren't fooled by.
Yeah. It was cutting edge. I mean, for 1938.
Came out on Halloween.
Oh, I didn't know
tying
that.
Into things in 1938. And that was about it. There was a film in 1953, which I don't know a lot about. And then, of course, then 2005, the Spielberg Cruise thing, which was actually quite good.
Yeah, it's not a bad film.
Yeah.
And it is actually it is relatively faithful to its source material.
I was going to say the exact same thing because I remember like when I saw the movie and they had this whole bit about these like red weeds growing everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, I was reading the synopsis of the original in 1898, and that's exactly what happened. There were these red weeds that were like all over the place that they were using to drop water, and it's kind of interesting that they kept it that faithful. You know, it wasn't the only old culture thing that came from the, you know, Edgar Rice Burroughs wrote something called the Barsoom series, which was all about interaction with.
He wrote King Solomon's Mines and
John Carter.
I'm sorry, no, he didn't. I think that's Rider Haggard who wrote King Solomon's Mines. I'm sorry,
There's a whole plot line of like a culture on Mars, much more of like a humanoid type culture. Like, you know, the War of the Worlds, they're like monsters coming here. You know, they don't really resemble us. I think in the other one, there was like a princess of Mars that was coming down.
I must confess, there's always like there's references to like pyramids on Mars, and it all seems to be tied in at some level, I guess, because of all the
it's gotta be like the level of imagination. C.S. Lewis did a Mars thing called Out of the Silent Planet,
writer
of Chronicles of Narnia.
Chronicles of Narnia.
And then, of course, you know, this is where we can cue up here. Like another iteration of War of the Worlds, though, was something I had never heard about until you mentioned, which is what do we call it? A prog rock?
It's a prog rock opera.
Well, it's not opera, though, because it's not sung plot. There's a voiceover plot. But it's not like the songs have...
Now, it's interesting.
Which song is this?
This is the very first one. This is...
Eve of War or something?
Yes, the Eve of War. So it's a 9-minute sort of late 70s prog rock track, very heavy synthesizers and what have you. And I guess I will talk about this a little bit.
Do we not have the voiceover at the beginning?
I think we missed it, but the voiceover will appear a bit later.
Well, I mean, it's kind of a famous person.
Yeah. Well, maybe we need to explain to people what this is first. This thing lasts an hour and a half.
It's War of the Worlds. It's War of the Worlds. Done in musical form.
Yeah, it's a...
Because at the beginning of War of the Worlds, like when the first happens is in the book, somebody in a telescope sees explosions. And like, so we know something's going on, and then the spaceships gradually get here. So I'm assuming Eve of War or War is Coming or Eve of War, whatever it is sort of the song that goes along with knowing that they're coming here.
Well, I'm going to let it play until he starts talking, because I guess we need to explain to people what this is, really.
I don't know when he's going
to
talk.
Well, he's going to talk soon.
You think?
Turn that down and let me find it. What? If you can talk about Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds, then.
I can't say anything about it. I mean, like, listen, the email exchange that we had was, wow, you surely heard this. This was huge. And I said, I've never heard a bit of this. This is, I should say, I can give some basic facts. 1978, it was released.
Crowd gathered on the common, hypnotized by the unscrewing of the cylinder.
Oh, this is after it lands.
Yeah. 2 feet of shining screw projected when suddenly the lid fell off.
And this is Richard Burton.
Famous Richard Burton, yeah.
Jeff Wayne was American.
From Long Island, I think.
Oh, sorry.
But he plied his trade in England. He used to do a lot of music for... He worked with different rock acts of the time as a producer, but he also actually wrote advertising jingles and themes for TV shows.
I saw something that says that one of these songs was like going to be a Lego song.
Going to be a Lego song, yeah.
And I guess they didn't take it or something happened.
Anyway, basically, it's a concept album where he got together all these British recording stars, a gentleman named David Essex, who'd had some hits in England, what's his name from the Moody Blues got involved in this, and basically
it sounds like a Moody Blues thing.
It's an hour and a half of this sort of music, and Richard Burton and some of the other voices read sections and interact bits of the War of the Worlds. And I'm going to say this: it came out in 1978. This was everywhere. When I was a kid, everyone had copies of it. There's the famous artwork of a Martian sort of spider robotic thing. The cover of the album, the tripod thing, is attacking the Thunder Child, which is a warship from the book.
Right.
Famous album cover. The thing was huge.
Yeah.
Some of these songs made it to the top of the British charts, and like I say, it was constantly being played on the radio. Even though most of the tracks on the album are anywhere from 7 to 10 minutes, Jeff Wayne made 3.5-minute versions so they could play the singles on the radio. I'm going to actually find the most famous one while I keep talking. But what I didn't know in researching this album, I thought this was one of those mementos from my youth. And I mean that, like I say, I associate it with a period in my life where everyone had it, and this was the album, sure. album you had. I didn't realize that for the last 25 years, there have been touring versions of this where mm-hmm. musicians sit and play it, and different actors and stars play the parts originally played by Richard Burton and David Essex. And in fact, and it was only about 3 or 4 years ago, Liam Neeson played Richard Burton's part in a big production at the Royal Albert Hall. So mm-hmm. in terms of British popular music history, this is a really sort of seminal album is the wrong word, but this is a really, and I just find it is a concept album, but I find the whole concept of, I guess, is it any different from Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice deciding to do a musical about Jesus Christ? Is it any different than that in terms of taking the War of the Worlds and let's set it to
No, music? I mean, conceptually, I like doing that. But I mean, there's very little plot to it. I mean, it's much more about tone in each of these songs because it's not even like a musical. It's not, it's not like they're doing lot of acting. You only have two voices on the entire thing. So it's more like a voiceover, and here's tone. It's more like it's more like the symphony that you played before, in that it's color on the way you want,
But I've now got it running, and hopefully we can hear it.
For 3 days, I fought my way along roads packed with refugees, the homeless, burdened with boxes and bundles containing their value.
Now this is lifted straight from H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds.
But by the time I reached their little red brick house,
it sounds like
Carrie and her father were gone.
It sounds like a holiday album or something like that. I mean,
so this is Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues, and this is he sings a song, and it's called Forever Autumn.
Well, there is words, so I guess I had to listen to it all the way through because the first few songs had no words.
I think this song went to like number 2 in the British charts and sat there for 4 weeks in like 1978.
There's no accounting for taste.
Some of the other artists, well, you like Thin Lizzy, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I like one or two songs. But
Phil Lynott from, was he Status Quo? I get confused. Phil Lynott was the lead singer of Thin Lizzy. He played on this album. So all these big British acts of the time.
I watch the birds fly south across the autumn sky.
It does not exactly rock.
Look, I'm not going to lie to you, it's horrible. But what I'm saying is,
I think it's fascinating that it was such a big deal. And maybe it just has to do with the difference between War of the Worlds' place and culture in Britain versus America. Because in America, most people connect it with the Orson Welles radio broadcast rather than even the book.
Because he said it in America, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
I think Orson Welles did.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is, and again, maybe we just spoke a few minutes ago about how the Steven Spielberg and Tom Cruise version, the Steven Spielberg version is quite true to the original text. But what's the first thing he did? Move it to America.
Mm-hmm.
That's maybe the biggest. Is it set on like Boston or in Seattle?
Boston.
That's the first thing he did is move it to America. So you're right.
Whenever we want to ever adapt a British.
You just said it in Boston.
You just said it in Boston, just like Fever Pitch.
Yes. But not The Departed, because that's from Hong Kong.
Oh, well.
Yeah. So anyway.
It's sort of like England.
Anyway, did you know, I've got some trivia about this album.
Uh-huh.
The Queen, I
assure you, I didn't know any of this.
Queen's album from the same time, A Night at the Opera, which has Bohemian Rhapsody on it. Right. That cost
not The Queen, but
no,
Queen.
No, Queen.
Yes.
Galileo, yeah, right. That one. So that's going to make next year's best of. Mm-hmm. That album cost £45,000 to make. This album cost nearly £250,000.
Yeah. Well,
and CBS Music, they were very nervous about this.
You know what the acronym ROI means?
No.
Return on investment.
It was huge. This thing was shit. Any of our British listeners, you're sitting there nodding, going, yeah, I'm with you, Zeph. Everyone else, forget you guys. Look at it. It's not my cup of tea, but I still find it fascinating that that a concept album could be as successful as it was in any country.
Do you think
Richard Burton got involved in it?
Yeah. So well, that, it is interesting, the story about he just jumped right on it. It wasn't like he even took any convincing.
I thought it was brilliant, my son. That's my best Richard Burton impression. I can't do a British person.
Not that great, but
I can't do a Liam Neeson.
Jeff Wayne.
Wherever you are,
maybe he'll appear on the podcast.
We will find you.
Who's that?
I am Liam Neeson.
Okay.
I will come to Mars. and kill you.
I have a very specialized set of skills.
A specialized set of skills. So anyway, that's Jeff Wayne's musical version of The War of the Worlds.
So what I think is the second biggest, and it's definitely second. I mean, that's the biggest sort of English language cultural popular culture Mars thing. The next one, though, that I was going to talk about was The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury.
Okay.
Again, we mentioned this running through time. So H.G. Wells, between the fact that it was 1898 and yet we are still producing, I think there's a movement out right now to do another War of the Worlds production that's very, very faithful to the book. I think there's some sort of like Kickstarter campaign. Do you want to do that as an interlude?
Yeah, I'm going to play this and because this is before we sort of veer away from music.
This would be good.
Because there is a quick side story.
As long as we're talking about British music, that
yeah,
it's not especially
from
good.
Sort of the same year, a couple of years before.
Yeah,
you say it's not very good, and you hadn't heard this song. This is one of Bowie's biggest hits.
No, it's not one of his biggest hits.
This is Life on Mars.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's not gonna resonate, I think, with a ton of people.
Can I do a quick 2-minute anecdote based on this? Not really an anecdote.
I'm gonna run a clock on you.
Okay, so are you ready? Here we go. It's David Bowie's Life on Mars. It was the song was used, the title was stolen by a British TV series from about 10 years ago called Life on Mars, about a policeman who gets run over and wakes up in 1970, and he doesn't know if he's dreaming or if he's in a coma or if he's dead, because he is suddenly transported back to the 70s where he's running into very different attitudes.
And about they kept policing flashing between the two.
And they keep flashing between the two. There was an American version that was made for a little while that ran on ABC with Harvey Keitel. I think it went about 12 episodes and then it failed. But this song is sort of the inspiration for the show, because this was a big song from back in the day. But again, it's just Mars in popular culture.
Okay.
That was less than 2 minutes, and I think I explained it quite well.
Pretty well. I just don't think of this as actually really having anything to do with Mars.
No, it doesn't, but it's still David Bowie's Life on Mars.
All right, back to big things.
Can I tell my David Bowie astronaut joke, or are we going to do that a bit later? We'll do that a bit
later. No, I don't want to come back to this. Do it now.
Well, David Bowie seems to have done lots of songs about space travel. I couldn't think of anyone less apt to become an astronaut than David Bowie.
There's probably a lot of people even less apt. At least
he could
go Ziggy Stardust and sort of arrive in the aliens in appropriate garb.
He was in that movie, The Man Who Fell to Earth, about an alien that comes to Earth in the 1970s.
Right.
So there you go. We'll just leave that hanging. All right. So back over to you, my friend.
So The Martian Chronicles, right? So it was Ray Bradbury, 1950. You know, another sci-fi writer who's done lots of Fahrenheit 451 is the biggest one. I guess he doesn't have, actually, when you look at it, he doesn't have like as deep a... It's not like Philip K. Dick, where tons and tons of his property has been turned into things.
He's more like Arthur C. Clarke in that about 7 or 8 novels.
Right, he did
of
this.
Which 3 or 4 sort of, Fahrenheit 451, Martian Chronicles, in the same way that Arthur C. Clarke is sort of defined by 2001, Bradbury, unlike Philip K. Dick, is defined by a couple of written works, of which Martian Chronicles is one of them.
Mm-hmm. So Martian was one of the things. This is a total sidebar. As I was looking at this, I was trying to figure out, why is it Martian, M-A-R-T-I-A-N,
okay,
instead of Martian, M-A-R-S-I-A-N,
okay,
because the planet is Mars. And there's not a lot of great national analogs. I mean, you have Russia, similar. Russians. We don't make that T-I-A-N. I thought Belarus is kind of a similar word structure, and I'm pretty sure they're Belarusians. I don't think they substitute in a T there.
So what you're saying is it should be Martian.
In theory, right?
But it could be confused with Mahjong or Marsha.
Right.
Marsha.
Apparently, if you look into the, I actually found a Reddit is, you know, the website with all the like sort of message boards that was big into linguistics, and somebody posed that, and somebody, I mean, levels of classic Latin declination that I couldn't get my head around what the different parts are, but what they pointed out was that... That's my phone ringing, which I thought I put on mute. But anyway, if you go back, the root of both Mars and things with T's, like martial, like we mentioned before, martial, it's, you know, having to do with more martial arts and the right. Like when you go back to the root word, it's actually got a T, So Mars is a derivation one direction where you put an S on there. I think it's there, like there's old versions of the word that would have had a T in there.
So really, it's actually, it's not Martian that's misspelled. It's Mars, right. Should be Mars.
That's right. Yeah. But yeah. I'm going I think that's some, obviously not.
I'm going
it's obviously
to
not Latin written because some, it wouldn't be the words, but
to get a cheap cooler.
Right. So, but apparently fishing it ended up like, but at that point, once you had Mars and you want to apply it in this way, you could have certainly made it Martian, but apparently it was H.G. Wells again in giving the name to things, made them Martians.
Okay.
And in fact, I think it said the first time it was used as an adjective versus first time it was used as a noun, like Martian was describing, you know, things of Mars, but not. A person, a character that was like in 1877,
and or an alien.
H.G. Wells adopted it, and that's how it became Martian for all of us. Important side note, or an unimportant side note. Anyway, for people who don't know, the Martian Chronicles are basically another one where it was sort of serialized, but it broke into basically three broad acts.
Yes,
folks from Earth go to Mars, or they're trying to get to Mars. There are Martians there, like of a humanoid type who have a culture and et cetera. It's the struggle of getting established there. Towards the end of that first part, we find out that most of the Martians have been killed by some disease we brought there. And
ooh, that's a twist on the
exactly.
standard. Yeah, yeah.
So now the next chapter is us continuing to establish the colonies on Mars, but really not a lot. Like you basically occasionally encounter the rare actual Martian, but we've kind of reduced them. Then there's a war building on Earth. A bunch of people go back, end up with a smaller population of Earthlings on Mars, who are then separated by virtue of this war breaking down things on Earth, and they sort of become the new Martians. And so it's sort of an interesting sort of the steps of cultural change and societal change.
So I'm still trying to get my head around the fact that Mars seems to struggle with the common cold. So Vicks,
well, it seems like a bum rap.
They need to be on the first.
They come to Earth. They get sick
when they get there.
Right. In H.G. Wells, they come to Earth. They get sick.
They get sick.
We go up there. They get sick.
They get sick. Yeah.
There's no germs that they have to knock us out.
Their healthcare's got to be a nightmare.
Yeah. But the big thing that probably folks might know of it. I mean, this. Now think about this. Right. We were just talking about a wave of Martian thing. This. All these things happened in the late '70s, early '80s. Yeah. Could this have been Star Wars related?
I would have thought so.
That could be it, right? Like, so like in 1978, Star Wars comes out. People start thinking about space and sci-fi. They start looking at what they have and they're like, oh, you know, we could take the H.G. Wells thing and make it into a concept album. Oh, you know what? We could take that Ray Bradbury thing and turn it into a story.
It was part of mid to late 70s sci-fi boom. Can I actually quickly do an aside and then, because I'm going to promote an upcoming show. I have told you that we're cutting together a Star Wars special to celebrate.
It's good that you told me that we are doing that.
Well, yeah, I'm telling you that I am doing it to release under our banner, but it's basically going to be highlights of all our discussions about Star Wars. I remember in one of the highlights that I just listened to, we were deciding, do Star Wars fans have a name? The same that Trekkies have a name.
Are you going to say Star Warsians?
Star Warsians. There you go. And that's copyright Atlantic Voice. Right. So we're getting in there right. So WARTIAN. Because it's just like Mars.
It's not too bad,
Star Warsians. Not too copyright. We own it. Don't rip us off. So I just want to get that out there.
All right. So 1979, this comes out. It was actually a joint. I didn't realize
it was
a
joint.
In America.
I saw it in the UK.
Right. Turns out it was a joint NBC-BBC production. So explains how it showed up on both sides. It was a miniseries, only a three episodes, something like 4 hours worth of content. Yeah, with Rock Hudson, with, you know, it had a very late 70s. Bernadette Peters is in it.
Gloria Honeycutt.
Bernie Casey, who is the African-American former football player who was the head of the Tri-Lambs in
Revenge of the Nerds. Yes.
He's the executive office president or whatever it is. You mentioned Darren McLennan, right? Roddy McDowell, who appears to all.
Who was, of course, he was one of the monkeys in Planet of the Apes. That was Roddy McDowell's big sci-fi role.
Sure, oh yeah.
One of the chimps, I don't know which one.
He was the main one, Caesar, right?
Caesar.
Yeah.
Is he Caesar?
It's confusing now because of the new movies. I think it was Caesar in the originals.
Whatever, he's one of the monkeys.
not monkeys with the two E's.
We're not doing that show. We're doing Mars. So Planet of the Apes, that's a different planet.
All I remember about it, I mean, I saw it, but in that era, pretty confusing, right?
It's pretty horrible.
You couldn't tell what's going on. I just remember the props and things were very cheap. Maybe that's the BBC element. It was a little Doctor Who-ish looking. They had those like weapons that were just looked like an umbrella over somebody's arm.
Yes.
And they had these weird sort of masks and like long flowing white robes.
And the Martians are very clear. The Martians are all bald.
Yeah.
Yes. Even though they're all speaking English, that's how they differentiate them from ours, is they give them no hair.
I need to go check and see if it's like on Netflix or YouTube.
It is on YouTube because I actually looked around to look on
bits. I can't decide whether that would be worth.
It's not.
Yeah.
I mean, Ray Bradbury said it's horrible.
Yeah.
He just said it was really boring.
Yeah.
Like any miniseries, especially from that time, the first episode is a wonderful setup. It pulls you in. You want to know what's going to happen. And then like any miniseries, the first episode is always great, and then the resolutions suck. And I think that's kind of what happened with it. But it's very slow, and yeah, it feels like a very slow, bad episode of old Star Trek, which of course was also, and there was probably old Star Trek sets thrown in with Doctor Who sets that they used up. Yeah.
I remember looking like the vehicles. I remember it just had to feel like it was a car that people, it was like a float in a parade. Yes. Like somebody had put a thing over it. So it didn't like really look like it was like a cardboard box over a car, basically.
So that's Martian Chronicles.
Yeah, Martian Chronicles. There's obviously, you know, when you look, there's actually a whole Wikipedia page on Mars and popular culture and just, you know,
it's amazing how
every
much
other,
there is.
You know, like just tons of stuff. But the next little wave that sort of stands out to me is in the year 2000. We had two movies come out at almost the same time. You always have this, like we a couple of years ago, we had
the
two movies about the White House being blown up. Well, I forget.
Two asteroids. White House down, Olympus has fallen.
Right.
Test me. It's like a parlor game. You name me one and Armageddon.
What's the corollary?
It's the other one that kind of sucks. With the president is Morgan Freeman, and they all go and hide at the end. It's the other asteroid movie. Thing. Yeah, it came out that summer. And
it's got to be the case that like
my mind is gone. I can't remember.
Somebody in Hollywood starts talking about a plot line.
Yes.
And I think it's not that like somebody gets the idea that to then write one, but they already have one. Like it's been floundering around. They realize, well, listen, if we don't push it out now, nobody's going to like. If a Mars movie comes out this year, they're not going to want to see a Mars movie a year and a half from now. So let's have a race to see who can get theirs out at the first time. And I think the net result on these is they both were bad. Mission to Mars was one. Brian De Palma.
Which one do you think is better?
I think Mission is probably better.
Was that the first one or the second one? Because remember, our standard rule is when these movies come out in pairs, always go with the second one.
I don't have the specific dates on it. I don't think I can pull that
Mission to Mars and the other one was Red Planet with Val Kilmer. So we're now going to have a debate. I actually have seen both. I like Red Planet with Val Kilmer better. I think it's a more stylish, a better looking movie. It's actually more exciting.
Fair point. I've seen the other one, Mission to Mars more recently.
Mission to the Mars has Tim Robbins, very slow, Don Cheadle, Jerry...
Gary Sinise.
It just sort of plods along. It's all to do with some Connie Nielsen.
And Kim Delaney.
And it just sort of plods along, very slow. It's sort of like it wants to be like 2001.
It is very much, I think it does. It's like a bad version of 2001. It's even got the computer that sort of talks slowly.
And directed
they have to reboot the computer and all this
directed
stuff.
By Brian De Palma.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, Red Planet, is Val Kilmer. And
Carrie Ann Moss, Tom Sizemore,
Terrence Stamp, and Benjamin Bratt are all in it. Yep. And what's his name? Simon, who's the mentalist.
Oh, gee, yeah.
I think it's him.
Yeah.
I actually like that movie better. I think it looks better. It's red. I mean, again, these are sci-fi movies. If you don't like sci-fi, you're not going to like them anyway. Basically, Red Planet is all to do with the mission to Mars, and then the robot goes berserk and starts killing everyone. Okay, so I've given that away. But
when I was reading this, there's a couple of things where there's like...
The production design on Red Planet is great. The spacesuits, unlike Mission to Mars, that attempts to look like we think it would look in reality. Mm-hmm. If NASA were going now, it would look like the movie Mission to Mars. Red Planet looks like one of those 50s sci-fi movies with very cool helmets and cool spacesuits.
Uh-huh.
And I just think it's a far more stylish piece of science fiction. That's my opinion.
All right, I'll buy that. The interesting thing about it, underlying it, you'd think, oh, maybe it's like the same story, but it's not. I mean,
I think the robot went berserk because it was tired of working with Val Kilmer. Da-dum.
Yeah. Apparently, it actually went berserk because what did they
took the same drugs to re-
they were trying to they were trying to grab a piece of technology out of it and like in order to save themselves, and it took that as a threat and started going nuts on them. But it's very like the Red Planet. The plot line is they're sending a bunch of things there to terraform it. They've like they've sent algae up there that's supposed to grow and it's not working out. And it turns out they roused some sort of bug, basically that is. It's a Martian form of life.
No, really?
But it's a primitive form of life. And it's good in that it ultimately creates oxygen on the planet.
Yes.
But it's a big mess when they get up there. But nothing about intelligent life. It's just about like trying to get there. This is about the struggle of getting there. Whereas the mission to Mars, and this big spoiler for anybody who wants to see this 15-year-old movie now, but in Mission to Mars, they go there and they discover evidence of a formerly, well, they were intelligent, but they're not there anymore. Not formerly intelligent.
Yeah, they have something that looks like a sphinx or something, like a rock formation that looks like a sphinx, and then it's to do with DNA.
And apparently, it turns out that this very Prometheus-ish, the story goes that once they figure out what it is, they realize that actually humans are descendants of life that was spread from Mars.
So again, and this is the wonderful,
which is we've talked about before, not Mars per se, but we talked about all these things about like whether humans are really from Earth.
And at the end of the day, isn't that Total Recall? Alien civilization, you've got to turn on the machine so it makes an atmosphere.
Well, that part, but I don't think the idea is that they said created humans.
The bottom line is,
like, we've actually talked about scientific theories,
yes,
that human beings are not actually from Earth originally, that we somehow were based on an animal mixture that came from somewhere else.
Have I said that?
And that's why we stand up. And that's why we get sunburned easily. You were pretty convinced it was true when we talked about
it. I am, because that's always my position, isn't it? I'm for alien and for someone has come from somewhere else.
Right.
Exactly.
Speaking of sunburn, like one of the things apparently all these trips to Mars, they say the one thing is that everybody gets roasted by radiation. Like the amount of radiation that you would expose to on the flight and being on Mars, because Mars doesn't have a protective atmosphere against solar radiation.
It has a very thin atmosphere and 30% gravity.
It has no magnetic field that keeps the magnetic field on Earth deflects radiation. That's what the aurora borealis is that kind of coming through the poles, and so that's where it happens.
Get your ass to Mars.
Oh yeah, just gonna go redo that.
So Total Recall, the best of the Mars movies? No, yeah. Yes.
No, well, you know, the best of the ones probably the one that's coming up here.
Which
I can do my cue. We're going to do a full on
reason for doing this whole show.
Shift into one of our like classic movie type things.
Yeah, because I'm going to hammer this movie.
Ugh, you're wrong though. I was skeptical that the trailer would play well on the podcast.
I guarantee you that at some point everything's going to go south on you.
Ready?
It's a little loud.
You're going to say this is it. This is how I end.
Commander, Mark is dead.
We have to go now. Yeah.
Now you can either accept that, or you can get to work.
This will come as quite a shock to my crewmates, and to NASA, and to the entire world. But I'm still alive.
Surprise.
Here's the rub. It's going to be 4 years for another mission to reach me. And I'm in a hab designed to last 31 days. So I got to make water and grow food on a planet where nothing grows.
Curse coming
but
up
if
here.
I can't figure out a way to make contact with NASA, warn
everybody.
None of this matters anyway.
We've got an incoming message.
Mein Gott. Mark Watney is still alive.
In your face, Neil Armstrong.
All right.
So I can skip this curse. He basically says he's going to have to deal with science on this. So,
all right, so that's a mission to Mars where they have to go back and get one of their astronauts that they left behind.
The Martian.
Oh, I'm sorry, because the plot is just like Mission to Mars they have to go back and rescue Don Cheadle, who's been left behind on Mars. Isn't this just like that other movie from 15 years ago?
Not really, but in this one, they inadvertently, like they think he's dead, they go to leave,
okay,
and then they figure out he's alive there.
They being basically the crew of the movie Interstellar, because everyone who was in Interstellar last year seems to be in this.
And then some. I mean, yeah. It's Matt Damon, Jessica Chastain, Kristen Wiig, who on this thing, that she doesn't say a single word, but we do see her there for a second there. I don't know what role she's playing. Jeff Daniels, Michael Pena, Sean Bean, who doesn't even appear in this thing. Cheadle Ejiofor, I can't remember how you pronounce that name, but he's the guy from
he's from 12 Years a Slave. Yeah.
Donald Glover, who is from Community and a rapper.
Okay.
Kate Mara, we definitely heard her voice.
Yeah, we've heard her around.
This is a Ridley Scott production, which of course is no stranger to great sci-fi.
And also no stranger to crappy sci-fi.
What do you mean? What's crappy?
Prometheus. Prometheus is rubbish.
Whatever. Alien.
He's Blade Runner right now. This also is a swing game for him.
No. He's Alien and Blade Runner. That already makes him 2-0.
Okay, he's 2-1 with
Black this Hawk one on Down, deck. Thelma and Louise, Gladiator. I mean, this guy's pretty good.
American overall. Gangster.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, personally, of his recent career, I actually think that's one of his greatest movies was American Gangster from about 6 years ago with Denzel Washington and Russell Crowe. Yeah. So anyway, Matt Damon, basically, he's left behind. They have to go and get him.
Right. Based on a book by a guy named Andy Weir, came out in 2011. It was a New York Times bestseller, which in turn, so the book was this whole story of, this guy being left behind and how he deals with it, which in turn was he released pieces or the ideas through a blog. Like, I don't even know if he planned a book in the first place, but it was just a sort of a thought experiment that if somebody was on
and you can
Mars,
write in.
How can they do? Yeah, like, so this is the way. Like, there's a Smithsonian Magazine article about like that it made the thing better by having peer review. In that he would put out an idea and people would say, I know something about this piece of science, and this is how you could potentially deal with it when you were stuck on the planet. Like, here's how you could deal with moisture for your plants, and you might be able to do these things to create things to live on, and you might be able to adapt this equipment to live longer this way. And so it's interesting because, we've talked before, like gravity, all the science grief these movies get when they come out.
Yeah.
Because everybody's like, that can't happen. But this is one where I guess
he wanted
by doing it,
to be,
this way, hopefully it's relatively faithful. Like I mentioned early on, the thing about the wind, apparently that's how he gets separated from everybody, is there's a big windstorm. And one of the things people said, like he even said, like, listen, I had to take some liberty. I wrote a version of it where cars, the vehicles they were in, just broke down. He said, but it wasn't very dramatic sounding. It didn't really work as well, so we put in a windstorm so that he could be blown away.
Andy Weir originally published the chapters as a free serial on his website, and then some readers requested that he make it available on Kindle, and then it first sold for 99 cents on Kindle, and then it was turned into a book, and it was a New York Times, it was number 12 on the New York Times bestseller list. It says here that the guy, the writer of the original novel, Andy Weir, is basically a computer programmer. He's worked for AOL and Blizzard. He also worked on the game Warcraft 2, according to his Wikipedia entry. There's also this great line on his Wikipedia entry. Weir is working on his second novel, initially titled Zek. He describes it as, and I now quote, a more traditional sci-fi novel. It has aliens, telepathy, faster-than-light travel, and I read somewhere anal probes.
I zoned out there for a second as I'm trying to do something, and suddenly you're saying
it's a more traditional aliens, telepathic, shoving things in you, which is my sort of science fiction.
Yeah.
This, I'm actually not very interested in this film.
I can't believe that. I mean, it looks fantastic.
Let me tell you why.
Off of a book that was really good. Everybody raves about the book. I don't just mean it was popular. I mean, people say it was a great book. I don't understand what you're complaining about here.
There are two reasons. One, this is the third fall in the row where we've got some big sci-fi movie coming out that's supposed to be realistic. And I didn't like Gravity and Interstellar. I was really let down with. So, you're not getting my $12 for this. Let me give you the other reason why, too. A lot of people are comparing this film to Apollo 13, that it's about heroism and NASA's ability to solve problems and survive. And that's great. I'm not knocking that. But here's the difference. Apollo 13 is a true story. So when I sit and watch it, when I sit and watch the Ron Howard movie with Tom Hanks and Kevin Bacon and Bill Paxton, I'm going, wow, that really happened 60 years ago.
Who cares?
I care. This is fiction. Of course, he's going to get out of it, and it's fiction.
No way. I mean, like,
you can tell me that this is factually correct. At the end of the day,
what he's going to do?
He's going to live, isn't he?
Why?
It's a spoiler. He's going to live. He's going to survive.
How do you know?
It's not heroic. It's just made up.
How do you know? You assume too much.
I'm giving it a thumbs down. based on the trailer. That's how we work here.
Well, you're wrong.
So if this was summertime, I would go. Actually, I would go. It's going to make a ton of money and it's going to get well reviewed, even though me personally are going to give it a
It's already out and it's well reviewed.
Well, there you go. So I'm already accurate, but I won't count that towards our total for the year.
No, I don't think you get entitled to, but that's crazy. I think everybody should go see it. It's great. I'm sure it will be great and interesting. And I mean, like you complained about Interstellar. This is
how long is the realistic movie? What does it say? Because Interstellar was 2¾ hours of just people blundering
so,
about.
So important to you about the lengths and the restroom breaks?
No, just because it was long and it sucked, and I don't want to sit through another space movie. That and I like. See, I'm a science fiction fan.
No, no, you're not.
And yet, ultimately, I'm continually let down.
You apparently only want to hear Apollo 13. You know, it's interesting. I was just listening to a podcast.
Apollo 13 is not science fiction. But it's not even about space. Because, it's just a movie because you don't about like NASA. Fiction. I don't count it as science fiction.
Apparently, you don't like fiction movies because the people already succeed in the fiction movies. The funny thing is that you would say that about Apollo 13 because, of course, you knew all the results, right? I mean,
yeah, but
that's
I know
the
that
thing.
It's
I was
real.
Listening.
That's the point. But it's real. It happened. It's
why? History. Why is anything in Apollo 13 suspenseful?
Because it's not about the suspense. It's about
sure it is. That's why when you watch that movie, I'm leading you into something. I just recently listened to a podcast with the producer whose name escapes me at the moment, but and he said that the way they manufactured the suspense in that was all the stuff with the families, because they knew, like, if you just watch these people dealing with the ship, you know what happens. It's not suspenseful. And so he said every time you see a scene where there's something going on, they would cut back to families.
Now, I've had 60 seconds to tidy up my thoughts. What I'm saying, okay, it's not about the suspense. What I'm saying is Apollo 13 is dramatic to me because of the dramatic delivery of the ingenuity shown to save some people from what seemed like a complete death moment. And what makes it amazing is it really happened. Matt Damon is a fictional character in fictional jeopardy. So to start off with, I don't care if he lives or dies, because he's going to be back in a newborn movie. So what do
so
I care?
Weird. It just makes no sense. That's like basically saying there's no point in fiction. We should just not have fiction anything.
There's no point. But no, I'm not saying there's no point in fiction. What I'm saying is don't try and make out this is some sort of... Because I've been reading reviews this week where it's like, yeah, this shows how ingenious NASA are, just like in Apollo 13.
I've seen no movie. It doesn't say anything about NASA. It says something about
NASA
a character.
NASA are amazing and, oh yeah, and NASA are now giving press conferences about...
You'll have to forward that quote over to me because I don't think that's what anybody's really saying about the movie.
I will forward it for you, and by the time this goes up on the net, I will put a link to an article that says, oh, isn't it great, showing how ingenious NASA are.
Zeph doesn't like fiction, basically. Well, speaking of whether it's fiction or not. So
yeah, it's a funny story.
One of the things when you're looking at in terms of this going to Mars thing, we should say NASA has been talking about going to Mars. They have a goal, like President Obama on April 15th of this of 2010. Is that right? Yeah, a while ago. So he announced this plan to be on Mars by 2035. And if you go to the NASA website, they have a whole website dedicated to stuff about Mars. Part of it is, you know, automated exploration, but they have this goal. They have a goal by 2025 to capture an asteroid.
Good for NASA.
Well, I'm sorry. You don't like fiction. You don't like nonfiction stories. What do you like?
I do like, no, I'm just a bit tired of NASA claiming they're going to do this, that, and the other. Right. It's like me sitting around going, I'm going to invent a time machine. At some moment, people go, Zeph's full of it. Well, you know something? I think NASA are full of it. Huh? So far, they've gone to the moon and
no,
then
they're
had a
going,
space shuttle.
They're going back to the moon.
That's it.
They're going back to the moon.
They've been talking about that for years.
Yeah, I know.
At some moment, NASA, it's time to step up and front up.
They're working
on it.
It's
put up or shut up.
Jeez, man. Got no patience whatsoever. Anyway.
This is why all these independent people are going into space, because they're looking at each other going, well, NASA aren't getting it done.
Or at least they're pretending to go into space. So Mars One, which is a project by a Dutch company, this dates back to 2012 is when they started talking about it. In 2013, they opened it up to applicants to go to Mars on a one-way trip, basically.
The CEO is a guy called Baz Lansdorp.
That's an awesome fictional name.
No, he's real. He's a Dutch entrepreneur. So actually, it's Baz Lansdorp.
Yeah. So he's supposed to go there. So the idea is they would have a bunch of people back when it first came out. They publicized that they had something like 78,000 applicants in the first 2 weeks of putting it up. Their goal was to get a 500,000. I don't know if they've ever updated their stats on this or not.
And you had to pay $39.
It was like weird. It was like some different price amount, depending upon where you were or something like that. And so like when it was money raising, but
basically more expensive than a Ronco rotisserie chicken.
Part of the hook of it was that, at least they planned, I haven't seen anything more about it, was a reality show about the competition for the spots.
Right.
Being run by the folks who did Big Brother, you know, the reality show Big Brother, where they hang around in the house.
It was originally a Dutch show. That's where it started. Yeah, didn't it? And then it was copied in Britain and copied in America.
The idea is that, they would apparently send things to Mars and ahead that then you could then live in when you got there, but they were going to send a bunch of people to Mars and they would just stay.
They have a budget of $6 billion to set up the first human colony on Mars.
What does that mean? They have math. I'm pretty sure they don't have $6 billion. Not a lot of people with $6 billion in TV production companies.
You sent me an article. Well, let me tell you how we got here. You sent me an article a couple of years ago going, oh, we need to talk about this. And I'm like, okay. So I'm looking at this Mars One thing and I hadn't heard about it. Then I looked on the date on the article, and it was from 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, ooh, well, let me see where all this is now, because this looks really interesting. So I started typing it in, and as soon as – you know when you type into Google and the predictive text comes up?
Yeah.
Lots of things kept coming up saying Mars One, is it a scam? So then I clicked on one of these links, and apparently there are different people claiming that it is a scam. And it's different people have claimed it's a scam to the extent that Bas Lansdorp has had to come out and say, no, it's not a scam. We do plan to do this.
Well, that's convincing.
That's what he said. Apparently, they are now down to their last 100. They've narrowed their field down to their 100 candidates. And if you go to the Mars One website, you can actually click on, they have different candidate profiles. And they all seem like, you know, regular Joes. There's not like, you know, regular Joes who have a background in science, but it's not like so-and-so ex-NASA executive or whatever. I mean,
the original article did comment on the fact that, like, it doesn't matter whether you were a jet pilot. Like, you know, we get astronauts now, and it's all about running the equipment. That's not really what they're looking for. They're just looking for people who – and that's probably makes sense, right? Like, the goal isn't to have a bunch of people who are good pilots. The goal would be to have people who are useful to go to space and do something.
Do you think I should apply for $39? Because they're going to need some entertainment. When someone's going to have to do some podcasting.
Because
they're going to live up there. One of us can apply, although I don't want to apply because it does sound like you're not getting your $39 back.
No, probably not.
So anyway, the guy as recently as this summer gave a press conference to say that, no, we're rolling. Let me have a look here. It says the delay in apparently there's a delay in paperwork, so it's delaying the first unmanned mission from 2018 to 2020. According to this piece from, I can't see what website this was on, the manned mission has also been delayed to 2027. So it does appear that Bas going to Mars, he's still continuing to throw it out there. But I don't know where some of this money's gone, and I don't know. I put it this way. Elon Musk and Richard Branson and all those guys seem a little closer to going to space than this guy, who apparently is a Dutch entrepreneur with a background in TV.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Probably a scam.
But probably a scam, but he's still out there claiming that it's not. That's Bas Lansdorp from Mars One, the Mars One CEO. So you don't want me to apply then? Or you might want me to apply just to get me out of basement studio.
You can tell them all why nonfiction movies are more interesting than fiction movies.
So have we come full circle?
Pretty much. I have one more musical thing only because I like the excuse to play some Fish tunes.
Can we talk about this briefly for a moment? Because for the longest time, you've been a Fish fan. I've never heard Fish. My only experience with Fish is being in Penn Station with a Fish concert going on above at Madison Square Garden. And I remember in the line to get a cab uptown, I kept seeing all these people funnily dressed. And I said to someone, what's going on, you know, while I'm waiting for my cab? Yeah. And someone said,
right around New Year's, because they used to do a New Year's.
I think it was in sort of late winter, early, you know, midwinter, late winter. And someone goes, oh, there's a Fish concert upstairs. So that's the only exposure I've ever had to Fish. I've never heard their music until you sent me this tune the other day.
I'm that hard to believe. There's a few things, but this is called Martian Monster.
The planet Mars. Look out, lockdown is progressing, and your spaceship is...
This is actually from a concert I was at.
Oh, really? Discovery. Is this a bootlegged edition?
No, no, you can get... one of the things that Phish does is you can download the shows right after they do them.
Oh,
and
really?
And if you go to the show, you get a free download of that show.
Very funky.
Yeah.
Very 70s, frankly.
Well, so... The thing about Martian Monster, which I didn't even realize, it's actually based on... Or the voiceover you hear there is from a Disney album.
Oh, really?
Called The Chilling, Thrilling Sounds of the Haunted House.
Oh.
And so it's basically a bunch of like one thing's about like a scary cat noise story or something like that.
Okay.
It was basically from like, I think the 70s, where they just did sort of a sound effects album. And Phish, every year at Halloween, tying it all back to Halloween, which is about we're approaching
around
now,
the corner,
they do like a musical costume where they play an album. So sometimes they played like a Lou Reed album, they played like a Rolling Stones album in its entirety as a part of a concert they're in. And in this one, they decided for Halloween they would play this Chilling, Thrilling Sounds, and they just took all the sound effects things and they filled it, like all this music is just filled into it.
Oh, can I bring this back to the start?
You mean to the start of the...
To the start of our show.
Podcast, sure. Yeah.
Well, now that they found water on Mars, Phish will be able to play there.
It's good things.
I'm not going to say anything more this episode after finishing like that. That's strong.
Right.
Your trip is short.
This has been the Aladdin Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric. Take care.
Surface of Mars. You are greeted by a hungry welcome drone.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at atlanticvoice.net. Email us at atlanticvoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for the Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.